Whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Attorney Michael Hallmeyer back with us for It's the Law segment of Dresser After Dark. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm great, Michael Ray. Thanks. How are you?
Oh, good. You know, I've looked very closely at the debt and the ceilings and all of the things that they're talking about, which most people don't understand. And I think what it boils down to, it's not about the economy. It's not about jobs. It's not about any of the things that cause us to be comfortable with our lives here in this country. It's about getting the vote.
Well, that's the bottom line. And that's certainly the soap opera that's going on this afternoon in D.C.
And I think it's unbelievable when we watch what's going on. They do not have our best interests at heart. With all due respect to them, it's who's going to vote for me. Let's go into a particular ethnic area and they'll vote for me. Or let's go over here to a particular religious area and they're going to vote for me over here. And Michael, it's an absolute shame. And the problem is we buy it.
It's really embarrassing, and like you put your finger on the key to everything. Of course, it only happens if we let it, and we've let it or things like this happen too long. It's almost too late for us to step in and say stop, but I hope that enough people will do that. I hope people are calling their representatives and making their voice heard, because we can't let it go on anymore. We can't just take a pass on what's going on and be too busy in our personal lives. Look what's happened over the last 2.5 years. While we're all doing our personal lives, Washington's made a mess of the economy, and it's mostly their fault.
No, absolutely. Look at the money that's being spent, the money that's going to places, what was it, $2 billion plus dollars that went to Afghanistan, and who got the value of it, the benefit of it? The Taliban. So we're dealing with this. Go ahead.
Yes.
So we're dealing with these kind of things all day long. We see it, but they don't care. It's got to a point whereby if they say it, that's the way it is, and this is who works for who. The problem is getting somebody out of there with a vote. It's 2 years, 4 years. You can't just do it overnight. Impeachment doesn't mean anything. Look at Clinton. I thought impeachment meant get him out of office years ago. That's not what it means. It means a slap on the hand.
I think that you've got your finger again on what's the key issue here. If the Tea Party and the folks who believe in the Tea Party break the Republican Party, then the only person who wins are the Democrats and the president gets reelected. Sure. Without that, if the GOP doesn't split over these economic issues, then the president, I think, is a goner next year. But there's a very real possibility that people are so upset with the Beltway Republicans and the Republican elite that's been entrenched and not really listening to the vote last year, as evidenced by what they're continuing to do now since the new Congress was seated. The Republicans have done a terrible job expressing their position. The Speaker talks about that he's agreed to $800 billion in new revenues, but he hasn't told us what those are. He has a plan that's being held off apparently right now from a vote because they don't have sufficient votes to pass it, that proposes a super committee of people who are going to make sure that the promised $900 billion in cuts over the next 10 years will actually happen. Well, in order to sell that, you kind of have to tell folks who are the people who are going to serve on that committee. Because if it's six Republicans and six Democrats, you need one squishy Republican, and God knows we've had a litany of them, to cross over to the other side and everything goes down the tubes for us, and worse. So at least if you're going to propose this super committee, who are the people that you, the Speaker, are going to put on that committee that we know are staunch fiscal conservatives and they're going to stand up for the issues that the voters clearly said they wanted supported last year? We don't know. Why is the Speaker not telling us these folks? How can they be mishandling this so much? It seems like the Democrats and the President have done nothing. They've not passed a budget. They've not passed a debt ceiling reconciliation bill or extension bill of any kind, of any consequence, really, over the last 3 or 4 months. And the only people now who are trying to effect a compromise are the Republicans in the House. Why is it that there's only this one-sided effort being made, and it's being made by people we are not sure that we can trust? That's why we don't know that we can support Boehner's plan.
Well, no question about it. And I think one of the, let's go to the other side for a moment. Michael, I think one of the biggest concerns that I have as I watch this constantly, that word concern keeps coming out of my mouth. And I've watched politics for many, many years now. And yeah. What I'm watching is a White House that stands up and says one thing, and you knew 2 days ago that something else was said. You know it's not true, but it's said in such a way that this is how it is, and if you don't believe me, too bad. I really think when it came down to it, when I heard the President of the United States say, I think it was last Friday, I want you in my office Saturday. What is that? What, are we got a dictator here?
Well, he's certainly throwing his weight around, and a lot of people have been commenting on that the emperor has no clothes. The curtains are being drawn back here, and everybody can see this gentleman for what he really is, somebody who is at best in over his head and ideologically driven, and someone who, despite all that warm rhetoric of hope and change in 2008, has not governed that way and continues not to govern in favor of compromise and bringing people together. But as you've often pointed out, works to divide and is attempting to conquer, that is, get reelected, by splitting Americans and pitting them against each other. People don't believe the pablum anymore. They cannot believe this president when he talks about wanting to be a uniter and not a divider. They see him as the ultimate divider. He has no credibility. This economic process, as far as the debt ceiling is concerned, is going on around him and despite him and having nothing to do because of him. Is he leading the United States toward a resolution? He's not.
No, and what he's leading the United States for is dilution, not a resolution. Michael, did you see this? There was an ex-congresswoman, I didn't catch her name, but I heard her twice on the air, and she was talking about they did it to Martin Luther King. They did it to Malcolm X. You know, who is the they? That's where the concern is, the violence that's going to be created if this continues. It's got to stop someplace because it's not uniting, it is dividing, and it is dividing dangerously.
It is dividing dangerously, and it's dividing in a way that's more permanent than having disagreements on different issues. You know, Reagan was able to accomplish so much of what he accomplished with a Congress that was mostly, if not entirely, through most of his presidency, in the hands of the opposing party. And he did it by working a compromise. He didn't get everything he wanted, but he was able to broker a compromise, and he led those compromises. He could not make the law, obviously, by himself. He's the president. He carries out the law as the president. Legally, it's the Congress, the House and the Senate, that make the laws that he then carries out. But as a leader, he can come up with a plan and he can propose it to the legislature to adopt. He can work on bringing them together and coming to a compromise. This president has not done that. This president has chosen sides, namely getting himself reelected, secondly getting the Democrats reelected, but first himself. And he has done nothing but name call and belittle Republicans who, as far as I can tell, are the only people who are trying to find compromises. This is the fourth plan that the Republican-led House has come up with in order to resolve this crisis. There was half of a plan offered by the Senate Democrats, zero offered by the president after his ridiculous budget was floated earlier this year and got zero support, including from Democrats. Where's the leadership? We don't have it. All we have is a Hoover vacuum in the Oval Office.
Some of the things that I'm starting to see also, too, his support, those constituents that were so for him are starting to back off. Now, even Harry Reid went into opposition about this plan that came up, and he came up with his own plan. But that said, I'm also watching people that are so glued to, he's wonderful, he's done a job. And I heard Nancy Pelosi last week, the first thing out of her mouth, I got up, I turned the television on, and she said, under this president, we've had more jobs. What did they expect us to believe? And because they say it, does this mean that it's true? There is a major concern. They wouldn't say it the way they say it, talk the way they talk, if they didn't believe what they said would affect a lot of people's attitude towards what's going on.
With the old media in their pocket, they're obviously following the rule that if you just repeat the big lie often enough, people will believe it. A lot of folks, maybe a third of the country, they're in Obama's pocket. They're going to vote safely Democrat, and they're the special interest groups, the bits and pieces all cobbled together with promises and dollars. You know, the stimulus dollars didn't go to help the middle person in the vast population. They went to help the unions and the government workers and other people like that. So they're paying off their constituencies, and those constituencies are reliable. They come back, they pull the lever year after year for the Democrat Party. But that's a third of the population. You've got a third of the voters who are supporting the Republicans, or at least the Tea Partiers and conservative, financial conservatives. And then you've got the independents in the middle. He's losing the independents in the middle. Those folks are the ones who are going to make the big change, and they're moving to the right.
Now, one of the things, and we've discussed this before, and it's no secret, but if people would buy Rules for Radicals, a pragmatic primer for realistic radicals by Saul Alinsky, who's gone many years now, if you read the book, you begin to see exactly what's going on. If I'm going to accuse you of the things that I'm doing, I'm going to do all the things that I can do. I'm going to yell louder than you do. I'm going to lie. I'm going to do all these things. And it works. I'm sorry. I wish I could say it didn't, but it works.
It only works, though, among those who don't know better. When you talk about Alinsky, your audience knows who you are speaking about. People on the right, people who listen to the alternative medias, know what you're talking about. They know who this guy is, and when you repeat some of his philosophy, they say, I hear you, I get it, I see it happening, I know what you're talking about. Then there are the ostrich people with their heads in the sand on the other side of the political spectrum who will never go and investigate. They're not interested in learning. They don't want to see what's going on because it's their guy who's doing it, and they don't want to have a reason not to be able to support him. The people in the middle are the ones that we're trying to reach. That's why your role is so pivotal, as is the role of the talk radio folks, the people on the blogs, the internet, the alternative media that we've talked about. You know, those people, you're on the front line of spreading the message to try to get people who are in the middle to open themselves up, to open their ears and hear and learn and go and investigate for themselves and find out who's telling the truth. And then they can see what you're saying for themselves. They can see how the administration is freezing the opposition and demonizing them and putting out dirt about their personal lives and shortcomings that they've made and mistakes they've made in their personal lives in order to force them politically not to oppose what the administration wants. It's a dirty business. It is seeable for those who will go and look. And I'm glad that there are opportunities like your program, the opportunity you give me to try to make a small contribution along with your bigger contribution and that of all of your fellows to educating people and saying the reality is not what you're being told. The reality is different. It exists on its own. This is not 1984, Orwell's book, I mean. You have an opportunity to learn the truth, and the truth is not what the mainstream media and the president is selling.
Michael, this is in the beginning of Alinsky's book. Lest we forget, at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical from our legends, mythology, and history. And who is to know where mythology leaves off and history begins, or which is which? The first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he won his own kingdom. His name? Lucifer.
Yep. And
that's Alinsky. That starts
it right
there.
There's been trouble going on ever since.
Yeah, but that's Alinsky. That's exactly how this book starts. And the key is
people who say this is our key to getting what we want. We just have to follow, and they are applying these tactics, and you're right to call them on it. We need to bring this all to everybody's attention, but there are an awful lot of people who are educated, who are continuing their education, and because of that education, the blinders are off, and they can see things for what they really are, and it's a very ugly, sordid picture. And sadly, part of that picture is what's going on with this whole debt ceiling debacle. Hopefully we'll get something short term, and that this issue will be finally decided by the voters next year.
And one other thing, and then I'm going to put the book down, because I've kept this with me, because as I watch what's going on, I can see the inside of this book. And on, was it page 10? How about I just give you this, and then I'm not going to get into the whole thing. Michael, it's the ideology of change. There's the politics of change. But the key is, what is change? And I ask that rhetorically. That's what the problem is. We're going to change, we're going to change, we're going to change. But change to what? Define it. Let me know what it is. What's inside that message? And what is government? And what is this country? Michael, we've got to a point in this country where you can get sued for having an American flag up. You don't dare say the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. You know I'm Jewish, but I really object to not having Christmas in the schools and the rest of it anymore. And it goes on and on and on. The culture is being attacked. And because the culture is being attacked, the very world that you and I were brought up in, it's leaving very rapidly, and I'm not interested in becoming a Middle Eastern country.
Well, I share that, and I think the only way that we can take the country back and restore it to a common sense footing is getting full circle back to what you started our conversation today with. People have to get out and make it happen. They have to stand up. They have to take a stand. You saw it happening once this administration got going, and it became clear that the direction it was headed was not the direction that it promised to go in. And that has galvanized a lot of people, but not enough. There need to be more people who hear your message and other people's message, the Tea Party message, fiscal responsibility, a return to American values, a recognition of American exceptionalism. These are the key to restoring the greatness of this country and returning it to the opportunity to exercise its true potential. It's possible if people will do as you say, if they will stand up and insist on it.
Absolutely. Michael, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, HOMEIERLAW.com.
Hey, Michael Homeier, I will be talking to you next week.
And we'll see about the ceiling then.
Okay, take care. Thanks, Michael. Good night.
Thank you, Michael Ray. Good night.
Exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there and
And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Brooks Olbrey's with us. He is the author of Blue Ocean Bob Discovers His Purpose. He's a partner at Investment Bank and Ion Partners. Brooks became intrigued by the philosophies of success in high school, but his interest in the subject was just ignited when he began to study the work of Bob Proctor. And after the birth of his son, Brooks became inspired to make these timeless principles more accessible to children. And he created the series, again, The Adventures of Blue Ocean Bob. And his first book in the series is Blue Ocean Bob Discovers His Purpose. Brooks, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I really believe that in the tagline, in that subline, the word purpose is so critically important. There's so many kids today, Brooks, with the confusing messages that are going on that have no idea what purpose is.
Absolutely, and I think in a book aimed at kids this young, it's kind of exposing them to the concept of purpose, but targeting their passions. You know, letting them understand that they can go after what really ignites them inside. And you know, I don't think kids need to decide their purpose necessarily when they're 6 or 7 years old. But as long as they're starting to learn about the concept of having a life's purpose, I think the book can really do some good.
Well, actually, when you deal with purpose, the way the school systems, I don't know today because it's been 200 years since I've been in school, but in the school system today, of yesteryear, it was a point where they would bring them into the different classes, the wood shops, the metal shops, the auto shops, and all of those things that if you weren't going on for ongoing and continuous education, that you could get off, in a direction. And if nothing else, it would have been a professional purpose. Obviously, when people get out of school, apply what they've learned and it becomes their way of life, purpose can either come or not come, but you have to recognize that it's possible to get it.
Exactly. And purpose, for me, and I think for a lot of people, it can be really doing anything as long as you're serving other people. And so, someone who's an electrician may find purpose in doing the absolute best job, setting an electricity plan in your house. And it's a matter of finding out what it is you like to do, what you're good at, and then what gives you that sense inside that this is what you should be doing. And in my particular case, I've done a lot of different things in my life. I didn't have just one straight and narrow path, but I found that as I followed things that got me excited and that I was passionate about, good things tended to come from that. And this book is an example of that.
Now, by the way, things you're passionate about, that in today's world, when we deal with kids too, it's so high tech, Brooks. It's very confusing for them. It's they don't touch each other anymore. They're texting back and forth, and the world is becoming so highly technological that we're losing that sense of human touch, that feeling. And the only people that are going to be able to bring kids back to that and get them to the point of purpose and spirituality or whatever it comes with it is parents. Parents have got to stand up and take charge of their kids today, and I don't think it's happening as well as it should.
I agree with that 100%. I think it starts with the parents, and the schools have a role, and as well as the extended family and friends, but the parents are probably the most important ones to guide their kids. And maybe that's one of the reasons I picked a picture book, because it's something that, I read to my son at night, and it's something parents can read to their kids, and even if they don't understand all the concepts in the book, they can ask the questions and they can learn and they can be guided by their parents, towards the answers. And so, I think that was part of my motivation. I have a 7-year-old son, but when I started this project, he was 4. So, he really motivated me as much as Bob Proctor was an inspiration. So was my son, obviously.
Well, the other side of that is what you're talking about also. The kids ask questions, et cetera. It's also a bonding process. It's something that you have a commonality with the child with. There's so many families today that the parents and the kids have nothing in common. The kids speak a completely different language. And if the parents talk to them or vice versa, nobody knows what's going on. I mean, it's all the English language, but it's been skewed towards whatever the culture causes it to be at the time. And I think in and of itself, books like The Blue Ocean Bob Discovers His Purpose, just the title alone would cause a parent and a kid to be able to sit down and really bring these things out. Because if you trigger that word purpose early on, it's in there, and they begin to recognize it when they start to see it.
That's exactly right. And as a admirer of someone like Bob Proctor, who really did inspire me to just go ahead and do this, you know, he would tell you that, you know, oftentimes, you know, adults have to reprogram themselves, you know, when they're older. And so my part of my motivation was, well, kids are so open. You know, let's give them good information, wholesome information. In my series, I don't have any evil characters, not to say that there's anything wrong with having evil characters like Disney would, but I just thought, let's have a total positive message and positive characters. And the challenges are, what? How do I get to my goal? How do I get there? It's not going to be easy. There's a lot of things I got to do, but maybe I have control of it if I think the right way, or I have the right attitude, or, you know, I look for some friends who might help me, or different concepts like that. And that is the kind of the philosophy that, you know, can go to the kids, and I think help them, you know, along the way.
Brooks, you can stimulate that kind of philosophy in just finding something to build. You know, how do you start? Where do you go? Where do you get the components at? What do you do with them once you get them, and how do they fit properly? That in and of itself starts their mind thinking that and life truly, 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 Brooks, is a process. I mean, it's not just one piece of the puzzle. You got to put the whole thing together to be able to motivate yourself clearly down a particular path, focus, or a purpose wherever you're going. But the point is that's the kind of thing that would cause children to start to recognize that there's a purpose. The purpose, first purpose, is to finish the project. And if it's that, they'll recognize it unconsciously, but they'll recognize it in other things along the way.
That's right. And, you know, when I did this first book, I actually wrote several stories, and, you know, it was a picture book. I just wanted the first one to have, you know, the first concept of purpose, but I felt that there was so much more to get out there that I've decided that my next book, while it's going to be in the same series, is going to be basically five chapters of the next things that happened to Bob on his adventure, which is basically to get hired as an assistant marine biologist on the island. But the, you know, it's purpose, vision, goals, attitude, and persistence are the topics of those five chapters. And I just felt that that perhaps putting it all together a little bit more together, as opposed to spacing these things out in, you know, separate books, that this message you just mentioned of, you know, it's a process. You'll get that out a little bit more easily for the kids and for the parents too. So I'm actually working on that and excited about that. It's the next thing I'm going to be doing.
I would venture to guess if you ask kids today, and if you said, what is purpose? Define it. They would have no idea what you were talking about. But if you started simple, the purpose is the, you know, working towards an end result. If it started that way, they would automatically know what purpose is. And then they would find a way to apply it to their lives. But if I don't have a definition, if I don't have some kind of a symbol, a recognition, if you will, of what purpose is, I'm going to get lost along the way.
Yeah, and I mean, in the book, you know, it starts off with, you know, what do you love, what excites and inspires to lead you to your purpose. So it's not, I think it's, Bob Proctor would say, and many others, that you discover your purpose. You don't decide your purpose. And so, but you can, you know, look inward and say, what do I really enjoy? And that can help you on the road. And I think it's a long-term process. I mean, I don't think kids, you know, necessarily discover, as I said earlier, I don't think you discover your purpose, you know, when you're 12. But, sure. You know, you certainly set goals, and you have things that know motivate you and excite you, and those are the things that you work towards.
Sure. And as you get into life, there's more exposure to life. You get to see more things. And as you see more things, there's more options, there's more opportunities, choices, probably the best word, that you can have. You know, if you say to me, you know, Michael Ray, what makes you happy? I can give you an answer today. But in a month from now, if I broaden my horizon, if I've looked at the world differently, if I've learned new things or been exposed to new things, that answer may change. And that's why you said it doesn't happen early on. I think purpose is a growing thing. And once you hit it, then then you recognize when you're on track or when you're not on track. And I really believe one of the indicators that you're not on track is resistance.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Although sometimes you have to fight through resistance to get where you want with your goals and whatever it might be. But I've found, I wasn't consciously aware of it, of the purpose concept as much when I was younger. But I think I had different, trajectories. I was heading towards different things. But at that time, those were the things that fulfilled me and that I wanted to do. And, right now I'm an investment banker, I'm a lawyer, but I'm also a children's book author. And the three of those things seem to fulfill me as a combination. I don't know if any one of them alone would. So it's kind of complicated, and it's also always evolving. But I think if you're always aware of it, then you're trying to fulfill whatever it is that you're, making you happy, what you think is going to make you happy, then you're on the right road. And new doors open up all the time.
Yeah, but what you're doing is an investment banker, as an attorney, your job is to solve problems. I mean, really, when you come down to it, that's really what it's about. That's all they pay you for. And when you're dealing with children's books, what are you doing in the book? You're solving problems. So basically, your purpose has been solid through each one of the endeavors.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I'm approaching the children's book world, I've tried to immerse myself as much as I can into the world of children's books so that I understand it and that my books are as good of quality as anyone else's. But yeah, I think I approached it more from, okay, here's this information that we have for adults. It's really good information because I know it works for me and it works for a lot of people. And so how can we translate this for younger people? So yeah, it was a problem-solving, the kind of catalyst for me. It wasn't, I just want to write a book for kids, any old book about, rabbits and dinosaurs. I mean, those are great. But I came at it from a different perspective.
No, absolutely. And I think when you really come down to it, and if you look at the core of what the book represents, and you're dealing with purpose, it's strong. Because in today's world, purpose has always been a tough thing for people to grasp, get a hold of. But in today's world, especially with all of these mixed messages, a confusing economy, the list goes on here. You've got political people fighting back and forth and whatever. What do those kids look at? They've got to be confused. And the message is that everybody's scattered. Well, if everybody's scattered, guess what? The kids get scattered. And I think books like yours, if they can see through and the parents work with them, they can move through these messages and get some solid grounding in whatever the life is about.
Yeah, and I think it empowers, my goal is to empower the kids to realize they have more control over their thoughts and their goals than they think. And if they start writing down their goals and they start setting their goals and they start trying to stay positive even though something bad happens, that they really can get where they want to go. And that's, that's been my experience in life, that a lot of it has been, I think, the proper attitude and then the belief that I could do it, and then just working hard and staying at it. And so that whole concept is something that I think is great for a lot of kids out there who might think they don't have a chance because of the things you're saying, because of what they see in the press or the media or what they hear or what they see in their everyday lives. So, that's the goal of the larger series, I believe. I don't think it comes out initially in the first book, although I think the first book I like a lot, but I think the whole kind of the system of thinking, of individual responsibility and things like that can really come through to kids. And they respond. It's amazing. They respond.
Brooks, I hear you loud and clear. Hey, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and buy the book?
Yeah, it's just blueoceanbob.com.
Wonderful. BlueOceanBob.com. Hey, Brooks, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. John Kimberly with us, PhD. He's the co-author of The Soul of the Corporation, How to Manage the Identity of Your Company. Very interesting words, very powerful words. He's the Henry Bauer Professor and Professor of Management, Healthcare Systems, and Sociology at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and the visiting professor at INSEAD in Fontainebleau, France. He's also the executive director of Wharton's Global Alliance with INSEAD. And I'll say, John, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. Glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Did I pronounce that right? Is that INSEAD?
I beg your pardon?
Did I pronounce that right? Was that INSEAD, INSEAD?
It was close. It's INSEAD is the INSEAD. Correct pronunciation.
Wonderful. I will never pronounce it wrong again.
Okay.
Now, by the way, the soul of the corporation, how to manage and identify the identity of your company. John, how many people in your experience are running businesses and they don't truly know what the base of that, the foundation of that business is, and they've never had a handle on it, and it's costing them at the bottom line?
Well, let me sort of rephrase that question. I think it's a great question. I'd come at it a little differently. I think most senior executives at companies that we all know and recognize are pretty terrific managers in the classical traditional sense. That is, they understand sort of the basics of corporate strategy, of finance, of marketing, and all those things that together make a business hum. I think what some of them underestimate or are sort of tone deaf to, however, is this issue of identity, and that's the sort of collective sense of who are we.
Okay, but when we deal with identity also, there's something called the value proposition. What makes you different than the next guy? Why would your perfect customer buy from you instead of the next person? In and of itself, defining that, and we'll call it the identity, gives you a competitive edge like most people don't have. But most people don't do that.
Yeah, and I think the difference here, Michael, is the difference between a value proposition, which is something you can put out in front of a customer or a client or a set of customers or clients on the one hand, and a sense of collective purpose, which is what I think identity is all about. And we may be talking about the difference here, and it's an important difference, between brand identity and organizational or corporate identity. Organizational identity is that collective sense of common purpose. Who are we? To what extent do we all agree on who we are? To what extent are we on the same page? And when that's clear, and when everyone is behind that, it creates a very powerful motivating force. When it's ambiguous, when there's some doubt, then that level of powerful motivation is compromised. A brand identity is something else. A brand identity is the identity that a particular brand has in the minds of customers. So everybody has an image of what Harley-Davidson is or of what Ford sure. is or of what Skippy Peanut Butter is. And that's a different issue. What we're talking about in the soul of the corporation is that sense of the presence and or absence of this sort of powerful sense of common purpose.
Now, by the way, common purpose is a very interesting thing, John, because if we truly look at it, most businesses, and I'm sure if you walk into a business and you break it down, you know, level by level by level, usually the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. They, if you ask them to write down what their purpose is, you might get a myriad of answers. And I really believe what you're saying, you know, is true. If you can just cut it right down the middle, and everybody's on the same track. One of the biggest problems businesses have today is they're, you know, with this global economy, everybody's reaching out and searching for the next customer, and they're going to give it to them as cheap as possible. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is what you're saying. It starts within. It starts with the people who work there. It starts with getting the customer involved. And it starts with that collaboration that you're talking about that uncovers that soul of whatever the business is.
I guess absolutely right. And we've got a great current example of the problem when there's some drift in that with the current situation at News Corp and Robert Murdoch.
Sure.
Where you know, there's this issue of a set of activities, set of actions that were undertaken by people who were at one level trying to do what they thought was the, quote, the right thing in terms of making their numbers, meeting the sort of performance criteria that had been established for them. But in a sense, what happened is that those performance criteria that were set for them forced them to cross a line. And they crossed a line that is going to, as we have read, has created some huge problems, not only for the company itself and Mr. Murdoch, but has also raised some very fundamental questions about the Fourth Estate and what are the appropriate boundaries. And these have been questions that have been raised, of course, for decades, and appropriately so. But these are questions which the Murdoch and News Corp case sort of puts in bold relief. Why did people who are probably in their own souls, good people, honest people, why did they cross the line? Why did they hack other cell phones? It was because, my own view, is because they were under pressure to perform. And that performance pressure led them to cross a boundary that they certainly should not have crossed.
Now, by the way, let's bring this to an issue that most people are aware of today. And I'm not political left or right here, just down the middle. What would happen if our government today, left and right, with what's going on with the economy, et cetera, and what they're trying to battle out back and forth, what if they were focused all in the same direction? And I don't think that they're focused in the same direction. I think everything you're talking about here should apply and would apply to what's going on with our government officials. You know, maybe they've lost their compass here for a while and forgot, you know, what the original purpose was. But I really think that you applied this to government, and I don't care who the president is at this stage, left or right, indifferent. If you apply this to the government, look how powerful our government would be, and look at the problems that we would not have.
Without wanting to get tied up, as you don't want to get tied up, in a left versus right issue here, I think you put your finger on a huge problem. And it's a problem that I find personally deeply disturbing. And I think of it as really fundamentally an identity problem.
Sure.
It's the extent to which the superordinate identity that we've all shared for centuries now, what it means to be an American, seems to be coming unraveled. And it seems that there is a polarization here which has led to a form of discourse which is coarse, which is hostile, and which does not admit of compromise. And it's compromise that I think has helped build the country that we have all historically been proud of. And it's compromise that seems to be in very, very short supply here because of the emergence of identities at a sort of a lower level than the national level. And
sure.
I think that's something we need to take a hard look at. I'm deeply disturbed by it. We see, if we look at what's happening in Europe now, in Belgium, and the identity issues there between the French and the Flemish, which has paralyzed that government for over a year now, we see a similar sort of phenomenon. When we look north at Canada and we look at the issues between the French and the English-speaking populations in Canada, and we see what has happened in Quebec and the issues of possible secession in Quebec. When we look at Russia and the former Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, when that sort of superstructure unraveled, it unraveled because there were these sort of more local identities that were more powerful. So it's I think you've hit on a major issue.
No, by the way, I'm going to go to your press release, and it says in this summary you'll learn it. I'm going to go right down to one area that I think is extremely important and is germane to what we just said: ways to manage the contradictory tensions that shape your company's identity. So the ground rules that you have here, John, it wouldn't matter if it was government, left or right. Again, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it was government or a business or how about a relationship. You know, two people trying to live a life. The rules apply, and if you follow the rules, you get focus, and if you get focus, you move in the same direction.
You get focus, and what leads to focus is a willingness to realize that you can't have everything that you want your way. It's true in a relationship between two people, as it is in a relationship between two divisions of a company, as it is between two political parties in a country. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, and let's take it a step farther. I'm going to go back to your talking points, but I want to go to the last one. How to manage your company's identity through mergers, acquisitions, spin-offs, alliances, change. It's all the same thing. If you have an identity, the identity has got to stay constant. And if you have all of these variables that come into play, if you do not know what to do, if you do not understand the process to follow, then you're going to dilute the company's identity, and you're going to end up with something that you didn't start and is going nowhere in a direction that you even recognize.
So let's take a concrete example here. Mergers and acquisitions. What are the identity issues there? Well, I believe that a merger is designed to accomplish two things. It's designed at one level to make 1 plus 1, that is company A plus company B, equal something that's greater than 2. So there's something about the synergies that are presumed to exist if these companies emerge that create excess value, that create additional value, right? So in an economic sense, a merger is... The merger math is 1 plus 1 is greater than 2. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is the psychological dimension. And here, the issue is 1 plus 1 equaling 1. That is, you bring two companies together, and you have to fuse it into one entity that's moving in with common purpose, you know, in the same direction. Sure. And if they're not, you've got a problem. And I think what we've done is typically in M&A, we place a huge amount of emphasis on the former, that is, on the economics, and trying to identify where synergies exist and so on. And we pay much less attention and sort of the integration issues, operational integration and so on, and much less attention is paid to the integration at the psychological level. So you have two companies that merge, two companies that are in the same industry, and that's one rationale for merger, right? You're in the same industry, so the two of you combined can do better than separately. But you've got two companies, two entities that historically have, in a sense, defined themselves by not being the other. So when you try to fuse those two, the psychological piece of this becomes a real challenge. And the execs who get that, who understand the importance of the psychological component of integration, that is what we would call the identity component, is what are we shooting at here, who are we trying to become, are going to be winners. The others are going to have a much tougher time, I think.
Oh, no question about it. And I think really when we deal with it, I'm going to go to the page Leading in the Age of Identity, the Common Ingredients of Successful Identity Change. And when we say common ingredients, John, the vision, the effective communication, consistency, leadership, continuity, luck, and positive signals. I would beg to differ on one of those at the bottom. But for the most part, what we're dealing with here is a process. And if you understand the dynamic, the components of the process, then you've got it. You just don't walk in. I don't think number five, luck and positive signals. I think luck has nothing to do with anything. Somebody once said to me, good luck. And I looked back and I smiled and I said, no, luck has nothing to do with it. Just wish me good skill. And I really believe the skill will bring you through what luck doesn't bring you. But again, it's a process, and it starts here. And if you follow the process, you follow the yellow brick road, you're going to find Oz at the end of it. And you're going to find what you're looking for. If you don't do the process, what you get is a lot of frustration and disappointment, and it's continuous.
Well, and yes, absolutely. And you get demotivation, and you get disengagement. And so all of the positives that you thought were possible, you were sort of reaching for the stars, it doesn't happen because you haven't paid attention to this, what I think is a very significant.
Absolutely.
And it focuses on a lot of the folks around process.
The question is why aren't you sending the books to all of our elected officials?
Yeah, well, I think they'd have a little trouble with it because I think that realm, there's the dynamics there, as I guess everyone knows, are pretty complex.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, and I think from you this can be an interesting answer. The authors, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, it doesn't really matter what, because it usually is the same thing. When you do your research, you're studying, you're moving through and writing the book, there comes that time where there's that aha, that epiphany moment, when you realize something, a dimension of the subject matter that you didn't know existed when you started this. Where was that for you?
Actually, that came before we started writing the book. It came as a consequence of a consulting project that we were doing for a multinational firm in the building products business. And they were having problems in a North American subsidiary, performance problems that they didn't understand. Their headquarters is in Paris. And so they asked Hamid and me to see if we could figure out what in the world was going on in their North American operations. And we spent probably 6 months interviewing people in both their U.S. operations and their Canadian operations. And it was a very, very interesting experience for us. And this is where the sort of mini epiphany occurred, and where we began to understand that there was something going on here. We hadn't thought about identity before this, but there was something fundamental going on. When we talked with the American executives of this company, they said, well, you know, all the decisions get made in France. This is a French company. When we talked to the senior executives in Paris, in what they call the état-major, the senior executive team, they said, we're a multinational company. We're a true multinational. So we said, wow, here's a very, very interesting fault line. It's a place where a significant subsidiary or set of subsidiaries see the company one way. They see it one way, whereas the senior executives themselves see it a very different way. We began to sort of think about what's going on here. And there were two or three other things that sort of led us to the conclusion that there's an identity issue here. The people inside the company, key players, are not seeing the world in the same way. They're not seeing the company in the same way. Their answer to the question, who are we, is actually quite different. It's not the same. And that got us thinking about, wow, maybe the piece of work that we can do here, the value add that we can create, is to try to work this problem and try to get, to the extent that we are able, get them all on the same page. And that was where it all started. And it's gone, it's really sort of taken off like a rocket since then. But it was fun, it was engaging, and it was a real revelation to us. And I think there's a there, as the saying goes.
And it boils down to, if I don't know where I'm going, I can't get there. John, we're about out of time.
Exactly.
Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Oh, I said, do you have a website we can find you at?
It's a personal website, and you can get at it through probably the easiest way to do it is just a Google Soul of the Corporation, and that'll get you right there.
Hey, John, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it, and you're spot on with what you're saying.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks very much.
Good night.
You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. We're talking about something called seeing. Seeing is believing. Andy Yates with us is the author. He's a biointegration practitioner, a Reiki master, teacher, attitude coach, and a certified adult and further education teacher, doctorate in clinical hypnotherapy, licensed massage therapist, and an NLP master and a trainer. And let us say, Andy, hi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Michael. Yeah, great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with the world in and of itself, how critical is it to understand the way the mind and the brain and the body work and how it all comes together for someone?
I think it's critical importance. The thing is that through my life, I realized at one point just how important beliefs are, because they are the thing that drive us forward. They are the thing that decide how we make decisions, what our attitude is towards certain things, and so on. And they completely define us in terms of our character and certainly, you know, the way we direct ourselves in the future. And it's surprising because many of our beliefs we don't even know we've got. They're sitting there in our core, in our mind, and they're making decisions for us, if you like, that drive us forward. So I think it's really important to get an understanding for that, so that you can understand and then maybe change them if they don't suit you, they're unwanted or inappropriate.
So in essence, we're being motivated and moved by something unconscious for the most part, something that happened maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, that we see something, we recognize it in some way, shape, or form, not consciously, but it triggers an emotion and causes us to react. And if we begin to understand that, life's a little bit better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's the point. A lot of people are able to see when they make sort of, I don't know, odd decisions. And you think to yourself, well, why did I do that? Why did I go down that road? I know I'm kind of in the process of writing my next book now. And one of the things I've done is created a chronology of all significant things in my life. And there's hundreds of them. And when I look at them and I think, why did I do that? where did I go for this? Why did, and I know that inside there's a belief that was driving me towards that, that made me make that decision. And then that gives me a clue to say, oh, I need to go and look at that. I need to discover what that is and why I'm making that decision. And then, you know, then I can get something more appropriate or something that will keep me going in the direction that I want to go in.
Now, when you're dealing with this, and most people have no concept of what's going on and the way the brain works, that electrochemical factory that sits at the top of our head, when people begin to realize that, they become aware of it, and it opens them up to something called options and choice. Because if you're not aware of it, you don't have the choice to think and feel differently. Now, I'm going to take you right to your clinical hypnotherapy. How does hypnotherapy work in uncovering these things?
Well, first of all, I've got to state that hypnotherapy is such a horrible word. I wish we could change it and just say, okay, write that word out and let's put another one in its place. Because it sends a bad message. Hollywood loves this thing and they just send all kinds of incorrect messages. It's important to know that hypnosis is something that occurs in us every day, many, many, many times every day. Because what it's about is changing our level of consciousness. And we change our level of consciousness all the time. Whenever we kind of consider things, we go back into our memory, we're changing our level of consciousness. Whenever we sit down quietly and read a book or listen to some music or something like that, again, we're changing our level of consciousness. So people like, as scientific as someone like Albert Einstein, they used to say that Albert Einstein used to go into a state of reverie, or actually a sort of a different state of consciousness, went to think about his new concepts, his new ideas. And he's thinking of things that are tremendously tied to mathematics and science. So it's not some kind of woo-woo thing. But that is the hypnosis. Now, hypnosis you could translate to just say deep relaxation. A deep relaxation when you might sit quietly, meditate, think about things, just allow your mind to flow. And it's surprising in our modern world how little of that we actually do. Because, you know, you've got your iPod on, you've got music in the background, you've got the TV running, it's all this kind of thing, constant flow all like this. And it's rare that you get a chance just to sit down and let your mind settle itself down and think about things. And so I think that's how hypnosis can help us. And it's really just a matter, the idea of certainly the first part of my book is to explain that that is a natural process. That is something everybody can actually choose to do rather than just having it happening automatically, which it does. And then they can use that process to give themselves a lot of help, a lot of focus and deal with some issues that they may have.
Now, by the way, Andy, where did you get your training at?
Well, I got my training in clinical hypnotherapy. I mean, you could say I got my training from life, but I got my training in clinical hypnotherapy in a few places. There's a healing arts school here that I did my first training, and then eventually I ended up with the American Pacific University, which is, I think it's now changed its name to the Hilo University. It's now accredited university. And I guess they must have liked me. They certainly liked my dissertation because after about a year, they invited me to join the faculty, and I was on the faculty for 3 years. So I did pick up a great basis of academic knowledge and things like this and being able to work with students. So you're learning a lot more of the sort of practical application of this. So that was that training. I'm also, of course, trained. I started off as an engineer in the military. So I've got all that kind of training as well. And I don't know. I do lots of different things, music and acting and stuff like this. So lots of different training. But specifically, that's where I got that training. I'm also trained in what they call neurolinguistic programming, which is using the language of the mind to help people deal with things. And it's also very powerful in exercises in communication. I've taught this to corporate entities to teach them little, I wouldn't say tips or tricks, but teach them advantageous communication so that they can better communicate that kind of win-win situation where the person who receives the message gets the message that is being sent, that kind of thing. So lots of training.
Yeah, I want to touch on hypnosis for a moment. You know, somebody, I once asked somebody what hypnosis was, and I got answers like, you know, you go into trance, you go into this, you go into that. The definition that I've got of hypnosis over the years has basically been this. A hypnotist's job is not to hypnotize, but to dehypnotize, to bring down somebody's level of sensitivity, receptiveness towards things. And I've heard people say, well, I've never been hypnotized and nobody can hypnotize me. And I think the greatest example of that is if somebody's ever been to the show, which we all have, the theater, and you sat in the show, you're crying, you're angry, you're something. You took words, you took a script, and what they did was they gave you a suggestive idea, and you're responding to it. So we go into that state constantly, and the biggest problem is when you're overtaxed and you're in that state, man, you're receptive to just about anything that can happen.
Well, absolutely, and that's how beliefs are developed. I mean, from when we start off from birth, I mean, it's actually fact that when we're born, our subconscious mind is wide open. It's just like a big sponge sucking everything in. And we don't have beliefs, because beliefs are like a set of rules by which we filter that information. And practically speaking, the sort of pipeline into the brain, from the mind to the brain, is not big enough to take all the sensory information we have. It just isn't. So we have to have some process by which we kind of chop it down and limit it and make it into sort of bite-sized chunks that will go through the pipe. And that's one of the ways we do it, by beliefs, because it has a set of laws which, similar to our kind of visual focus, focuses on one little area, like 10-15%, and then the rest of the stuff is seen but ignored. And that's how beliefs work. And the problem is, of course, if we have beliefs with these hard walls, so we can go outside that belief, and that's something I've talked about in the book, the edge of belief, we don't bring in that other information from the outside. We don't bring in that extra stuff and make connections and then progress and empower ourselves to go forward and become more, I believe, enlightened. So, so that's part of that issue. And we can pick up beliefs in ways, as I said, when you're a child, you just soak it in. If you're born to, as I was, born to Roman Catholic parents, well, I'm a Roman Catholic. It's as simple as that. If I'd been born to Muslim parents, I'd be a Muslim, because they fed me all my values and all that teaching. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it at all, but that's what they fed me when my mind was completely open. And as you said, there are other times when your mind is open. One of those examples is when you're in an emotional state. Back in the 70s, a guy called Kroger came up with a phrase that he used, which is single state learning. And what that's about is where trauma, all the sort of emotions sort of circle around together and allow it to drive one instance of something happen, being bitten by a dog perhaps, then makes you frightened of all dogs for the rest of your life. Just one time that happened. And that's how beliefs work.
Now, by the way, did you, in your experience, did you ever run into, no, he's gone now, but ever run into John Kappas and any of his work out of Los Angeles?
No, I know the name, so I've probably seen some of his stuff.
Yeah, it's hypnosis.
What can I say? There's lots of us.
I'm aware that John's probably been gone for maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years now. But what he talked about was, as you were talking about that funnel, but there's a filtering process. And that filtering process is like an analytical sense of evaluation. Something comes in, you analyze it, you use your logic, your reason. If it's good, it's bad, you handle it. But if there's too much, that filtering system breaks down, and then that's when the problems start, when things just flow into that unconscious mind. That's when there's no control, because that mind, you talked about NLP before, but the language of the mind, that particular mind doesn't think, doesn't reason. It deals with the language of pictures and symbols. And something gets in there, and if it does get in there, it takes it on as a goal to achieve. It's reality. And that, in and of itself, there's no choice with, until you can come to somebody like you who knows the difference, who knows how to move you out of it. But that's what happens to us constantly. We get overloaded, we get a suggestive idea, and it becomes, that experience becomes a belief, and the belief runs your attitude, which causes you to either come out ahead or lose in life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And some people drive their life by the craziest beliefs. And this, again, is what I've tried to address it somewhat in the book, because, you've got someone whose life is dependent on a cup of Starbucks in the morning. And if they don't have that cup of Starbucks, they're going to make bad decisions all day because their attitude is very negative. and they're in a forward, you know, it might be a sales-based or a marketing business or whatever, and they're going to make bad decisions all day, and they could change the rest of their life by losing an opportunity or some, you know, big benefit that's going forward just because they didn't have a cup of joe. And that's just crazy. But that's the way the beliefs are, and it's a matter of recognizing that and saying, no, I can deal without that. I can work without that, as I said, and that's some of the things I've tried to explain.
I think
I've always felt that the human being, and this might be a naive idea of how good and valuable the human race is, but I think we are on a path to kind of go through from being physical beings, just down in the mud physical beings, to much more energetic beings. I think that and that path of enlightenment is really about being open to knowledge, opening to different sources of information, and then making connections with that information as we go forward. And if the edges of our belief are like steel walls and we just shut everything else out and we don't allow a passage of information to come back and forth through those walls, we're going to lose all the stuff. I think we have to be discerning about the information we take in, and then that is what we develop our beliefs from. Not just open wide, but then also and believe anything, but also just not to shut things out. I mean, the sort of the area in which I work in hypnotherapy, neurolinguistic, Reiki, whatever it is, a lot of that is on the edge of people's belief. They actually, some people just immediately discard it and throw it out. And I think it's really sad because we offer such a wonderful, beneficial process like this that is perfectly natural and a natural part of the human being. And people have discarded it, and they'd rather take a pill than they would come to somebody and work with their own healing processes, their own internal pharmacology, and fix themselves. And then be able to do that in the future. And I think it's kind of sad that we've got that.
But Andy, more important than anything else, let's say I'm running through all of those things that you're talking about. I've got belief systems that cause me problems. I've got belief systems that I'm in a relationship, and if she looks at me a certain way, the entire night is ruined because of something that happened to me 20 years ago. I go into the job, and I'm having the same kind of problem. If we don't know it, look at what goes on with the majority of the population here. So it's knowing that and having the practical way to work with it whereby you can move through these things and come out ahead on them. That's why I think the kind of work that you're doing is absolutely critical. We're getting more and more into brain science. More and more people are beginning to understand the validity of it and what it can cause or, quote, unquote, not cause. So very important. Now, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. Probably the best one is our company website, which is www.trefoiltherapies. That's TrefoilTherapies. Trefoil Therapies. And trefoil is a three-leaf plant, and the principle of that is it's mind-body energy. That's the principle
Wonderful.
Of our practice.
And by the
there's
way,
links
thank you.
In there to the books and all kinds of things. I could think.
Great. Now, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been a pleasure. A pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
A girl that holds you in my arms, and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do,
till all my lovers' dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mark Farrell with us. He's the author of State of Mind, a political thriller. He's won International Book Award in 2011. With more than 35 years' experience as an import-export businessman, he's been president of corporations, an entrepreneur, a currency speculator, an inventor, a University of California graduate, and a political activist. He brings an international and historical perspective to our current economic plight. And again, he's the author of State of Mind, a political thriller trilogy. And let's say, Mark, I welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on. Certainly appreciate it, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, it's true. Fire the federal government. I'm ready. I'm on your side with this. When you decided to write the book, what was it that triggered you to say, okay, let me put this to pen. We're not really seeing what we should be seeing here.
Well, it was 2008. I was watching a lot of financial news on television, and frankly, I got tired of yelling at the people on the television, so I thought I'd write a book and get my frustration out, and it turned into an exciting political thriller that I think people will enjoy, but it also delivers some very timely messages to what we're experiencing right now, even in Washington, D.C.
Now, if you were to look at Washington, D.C. and describe the way politically it's being run right now, obviously, we're off focus, whatever that focus is supposed to be. I think we're all supposed to be Americans here. But what would you say that's the cause of the problem? Not an individual, but maybe an ideology, a way that it's moving. Because if you really look at what's going on year after year after year, you know, governments come and go, administrations come and go. But the one thing that remains constant is business. They're focused on what they're supposed to be focused on is money. And it seems as though in government, if we follow the money, we can follow and get right to the problems. Is this some of the problems that you see?
Oh, absolutely. We've lost complete fiscal discipline. And it's on both sides of the aisle. I would say that the left leads it a little bit more, but the Republicans have certainly been compromising our way into this problem. And the real difficulty is we can't compromise our way out anymore. We're at a real loggerhead. We are heading off a financial cliff right into a depression of inflation. It's going to be different than the 1930s where the dollar appreciated and dollars were scarce. It's going to be more like the 1920s with Germany when it took a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a wheelbarrow.
Sure. No question about it. One of your talking points, and I think it's critical that people get this, it's very important if we want to define who we are. We were founded as a republic of states, not a federal system, and we're rapidly becoming a federal system with the government owning everything.
Yes, and there is, there's a lot in terms. We have to carefully understand what each term means. There's a difference between having a federal government and having federalism as our system. For somebody like Germany, federalism might work, a country smaller than Texas with about a fourth of our population. But for us, federalism is a death knell. We are in a financial morass right now because we've allowed the federal government to control so many aspects of our lives, from our money and our economy to our domestic laws, to our social policies, and they failed at all of them. And now we're reaping the rewards of that centralization of power.
Well, let me ask you this question. I've been watching this very closely, and I've been around this industry for a lot of years now. And I don't think that they failed, Mark. What I think they've done is they've intentionally moved us in a particular direction. Now, failed as far as keeping us who we were, Americans, and living the culture that we were brought up with. But I don't necessarily know if they failed, because most of this looks like it's intentional. And at the end of the day, they're getting what they want. It's less for the people, more for the government. And again, I think it's intentional.
Well, there's a lot of validity to what you say. And the problem is, as an author, I try to walk a line that doesn't fall into the conspiratorial areas. But there are certainly indications of that. You wonder what people have in mind, particularly people that are supposed to be educated and know what they're doing. It seems that your only conclusion could be that we're being led down this path for a purpose. And essentially, it's socialism of the dollar. And it started back in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt being encouraged by very liberal people on his advisors to turn to deficit spending in order to counter Federal Reserve policies. So is it a conspiracy? I don't know. But all I know is the end result is the federal government has destroyed our currency. It's destroyed our economy, and we have to take a different route. And I don't think it's something we can correct. I think we're way beyond that.
Mark, when I'm not a conspiracy theorist either. I'm not, but I'm a pragmatist. And I watched the president of the United States a week before the election. This is everybody saw it, basically, say that he's going to fundamentally change the United States. And he was talking to Acorn. He was talking to the union. He said he was going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he got elected. So not to be surprised that he didn't do exactly what he said he was going to do. There should have been no surprises here. He told us ahead of time.
Well, you know, what's really interesting, nobody ever asked him what he was going to change. And everybody would just stand up and shout change. But they got their change. I hope they're enjoying it, because I think it's going to be the end for us as a under our current system of government. They've destroyed the base, and this economy gets much worse. It's going to be a serious problem. I don't think this economy is going – this so-called recovery has no legs at all. Oh, it's going to probably last in this current form for another 12 to 14 months, and then they're going to start pumping more money in again. You know, Michael, a couple of interesting points. Since 1960, our money supply has been increased by 7,000%. 7,000%. The dollar today has the purchasing power of a 1960 dollar of 14 cents. So we certainly, whether Republicans or Democrats, we certainly haven't walked a tight fiscal rope.
No. No, but one of the things that I did see that was a shock, and in 1960, what was I, 17 years old, I think. In 1960, I remember very clearly, which was very interesting, a pack of cigarettes in those days was 18 cents. And when it went up to 25 cents in the machine, everybody panicked, right? I was walking, I don't smoke, and I haven't for years, but I walked into the market the other day, and Mark, a carton of cigarettes is over $70.
Well, I'm certainly glad I gave up smoking a few years back.
Tell me.
that's ridiculous. It's like scraping up. I remember all of us going out on a Friday night and scraping up change because to pay for gas, because it was 28 cents a gallon.
Big-time stuff.
Less than a dollar got us around town for the evening.
No, I know. And when you really come down to it, of course, my grandfather told me this. It wasn't me, right? But when you really come down to it, that we have had changes, we have lived through things, but we have never had the kind of divide that's going on today. We are, bar none, the most powerful force in this world. Nobody stands up to us toe-to-toe. We take them. But if you want to get us, you cause us to implode. You divide us, you conquer us, and if you look at what's going on today, every place you look, it's either an ethnic divide, it's a gender divide, it's a business divide, it's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, Michael, you couldn't have stated a more truer fact, but I'll give you another divide of class warfare, and that is those that are on the federal dole and those that aren't. And let me tell you something. I'm not talking just about somebody getting welfare. I'm talking about all the people on Social Security, people receiving Medicare benefits. I'm talking about teachers, every federal program that funds something. I'm talking about the defense industry. You take all of this, and basically we're looking at a 50-50 split. 50% of us are providing the economic activity to pay for the other 50%. And any attacks on this is going to be brutally fought off by these people. And that's why I don't give a lot of hope for the future of us solving the problem in Washington, D.C.
Now, by the way,
these forces are aligned against us, and the average person doesn't have time to become involved to solve these problems, but it seems that the people that are receiving some sort of federal financial aid do have the time, and their voices are loud, and ours are not that loud.
No. As a matter of fact, I saw something interesting, and it was about, a month or two ago, I don't remember the kid's name, was in New York, and he was 27 years old. It was an African-American kid that was killed, and they called him the entrepreneur. He had six daughters, three sons. He was getting like $1,200 and some odd a month for each one of the kids. Why work?
Right. Well, it's a very difficult situation. They've spent our treasure. One of the other areas that I'm not particularly fond of are all these foreign incursions. Now, what are we gonna fundamentally have to do? Well, number one, we have to understand that we're broke. It's like going into a bankrupt company and telling them, you know what, we're going to have to get rid of the private jet, and everybody getting upset because you're getting rid of the private jet, until you make them realize you don't understand the doors are going to close soon and be padlocked. Get with it, people. I mean, we have to eliminate every entitlement program. We can't afford it. Social Security is bankrupt. We've already spent that money.
Oh, that's great. And by the way, that's not necessarily an entitlement program. I get Social Security, and it's, we won't tell anybody that or about the 18-cent cigarette packs, but I get Social Security. But how many years did I pay into it?
Okay, here's the problem. You just hit right into it, though, Michael. The first problem is we call them entitlement programs.
Yeah.
Like we're entitled to them. Here's the difficulty, is when Franklin Roosevelt set it up, he set it up that the succeeding generation would pay for the preceding generation.
Right. Yes.
The problem is you got the baby boomers coming in. We didn't pay for ourselves. We paid for our parents.
Yeah.
And
I got it. Yeah.
So we actually didn't. It wasn't a pay-as-you-go system. So therefore, the money is not there for us. And the next generation has no chance of supporting the system as it currently stands. That's why they're gonna keep raising the age level for enrollment in Social Security for the payees. I mean, on and on and on, because they cannot afford to bankroll it from a smaller number in the preceding generation.
Sure, but Mark, let me qualify something, because I was gonna add this. See, one of the biggest myths about Social Security is that we have a legal right to those benefits, and we don't. Because if you go all the way back, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Social Security taxes are simply taxes, and they don't convey any
That's
property
right.
or contractual rights to the benefits. So they don't really owe it to us. It was a tax.
Then why do we call it entitlement? We're entitled to it? Apparently not.
Not now. But I mean, but that's the way it's set up. That's the way it was set up. And I think the biggest problem is it was set up in one particular way, and it's been used another way. It's when Clinton was, Clinton had a good economy. He took the money out of the Social Security, the lockbox, stuck it into the general fund, and spent the money, and we were fine. The problem is we're not growing as many kids as we were, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and there's not as many kids putting into that fund. So that
That's
thing,
right.
I think around 2015, 2020, right in there, it's gone bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. No, and one of the other areas, too, are these foreign forays, such as Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we used to call ourselves the policemen of the world. We cannot do that anymore. We're broke. We can't afford to do that. We have to pull out of those places instantly. And I'm used to be pretty much a hawk, but the point is you got to be able to afford it to go do it. And we've got to get out of there. Now, the question becomes, if the federal government doesn't work, what would work? And I think we need to get back to the states. I think we need to strip 90% of the power of the federal government and return it to the states. And I'm talking even one that is in the Constitution specifically for the federal government, but is the managing of the economy and the printing of currency.
No, absolutely. By the way, I completely agree with you, because what's occurred is the federal government has superseded any of the state laws. The states can say whatever they want to say, but in the end result, it is what the federal government wants that causes the end result of what we do. Now, it's a problem, and I don't really see anybody on the horizon that's going to fix it, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Tea Party, whatever the case is.
That's right.
We have that person, that whoever it is, has not appeared yet.
Well, we have 50 bubbling laboratories of innovation, and they're called the states. And let them come up with the solutions to these problems, because obviously the federal government can't do it. There is way too much division. There is way too much intransigence of concerned parties, meaning those receiving benefit from the federal government, to ever solve this problem.
No question. And Mark, I hate to do this to you. We're just about running out of time now. Do you have
sure.
a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. www.mafarrellbooks.com. mafarrellbooks.com.
Hey, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Go get them. Good message.
Thank you. Thank you.
And wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Cyan, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Sandra Dalton-Smith with us, MD. She's the author of Set Free to Live Free, Set Free to Live Free, Breaking Through the Seven Lies That Women Tell Themselves. She's a board-certified internal medicine physician who has been practicing medicine since 1999. She treats a predominantly female population, has firsthand experience with the struggles women face by trying to imitate the American dream. And she's been an adjunct faculty member of the Baker College and Davenport University in Michigan. And let us say, Sandra, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I'm going to go to the tagline, the Breaking Through the Seven Lies Women Tell Themselves. Very interesting if you keep telling yourself something, not verbally so much, but nonverbally, you begin to become that thing. And it's very hard to say that's not who you are when you think you are. So how do you break through? How do you get somebody to recognize that what they think about themselves is not really true?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. So many women that I see have believed these lies about themselves for so long that it becomes their personal truth. And the reality is the truth that you believe that actually has the greatest impact on your life. In helping women uncover these lies and get to the root of it, a lot of times for me, it's come out within their regular office visits. A lot of women were coming into my office with complaints of just a lot of vague issues. That is, I'm not happy, or I'm depressed, or I'm anxious, I can't sleep, I'm having these muscle aches and pains, just a lot of vague, nonspecific complaints. You do all the tests, everything's negative, but they really do have issues. They really do have these symptoms. And I started asking women, you know, well, what's going on in your life? You know, what else is going on that's not maybe specifically medical? And people were coming back with things like, well, you know, I'm having this strain with my relationships, or you know, I'm having some self-doubt about my abilities in my career and things of that nature. And I noticed that the more women believed these lies, the more they started to really start living them. If they started feeling inferior, they started acting inferior. If they started feeling they were fat, they started dressing fat. You know, the lie started to take over, and it started to become who they thought they were. And they no longer could really see the truth because it just became kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sandra, the lies, and let's move beyond the word lie for a moment, but those beliefs that they have about themselves came from obviously someone else, and they modeled whatever that was and thought that that's how they should be in their life to get along and to survive. And by being something that they're not, the conflict comes, the physiological pains and the emotional traumas and everything else that goes along with it. It's a very interesting thing when you believe you're somebody that you're not, and the resistance to stay that way, I'm sure, causes hundreds of millions of dollars of people coming in to see the doctor every year.
Absolutely. Those unhealthy comparisons, you know, there's a certain amount of competitiveness that's healthy. But when it becomes your everyday life, when you're every waking moment, you're trying to live up to a certain image, and you're not free just to be yourself and to have your own likes and to be able to say, I'm not going to do my practice like that, or I'm not going to conduct my show like that. You know, I'm going to be an individual and do what feels right for me, even if it goes against the grain, even if it's a little, you know, unconventional. I think that's the freedom. That's the part, you know, a lot of people ask me, what does live free mean? That is living free, being able to say, I don't have to fit a mold. I don't have to be what you're used to. I can be me, and if I'm confident enough in my abilities and what I believe about myself, then I'm free to do that. I don't have to be bound by an image or bound by someone else's comparisons.
And I think a lot of that, too, that going against the grain, it can break up a relationship. It can cause somebody to move out of the job that they're in, or the profession, or the whatever the case may be. And when they make the change, they've got to be able to realize the consequence of the change. The good side of that, they'll become who they are and they'll live a comfortable life. The bad side of that is everything that they're used to. It's that break away from that, which has got to be very tough for a lot of people. What's that old adage? Better unhappy than unsure.
And that's the trap so many people have gotten into. They're living a life that they feel bound in. They don't really see a way out. They feel trapped in a way, and they know that they are feeling that, and it's causing pressures within their bodies is actually causing a physiological response where they can't put a name to it, but they can say, I just don't feel good. I'm not happy anymore. You know, life doesn't have the joy. And then, you know, everyone shows up to the doctor's office wanting that happy pill. And
sure.
They may end up with a pill. They may get a pill for something and find out that it really doesn't solve the problem because it doesn't change the underlying situation. You've got to get to some of these root issues and actually start working through them. You know, if you have a lot of problems with envy and you're always trying to get what someone else has, when do you get enough and when do you actually start enjoying what you do have? Or if you're always trying to control situations to the point that you don't feel insecure, when do you ever have the freedom to actually enjoy the spontaneity of life and the part of life reality is you don't have control over any of it, you know, but to get to that point where you're comfortable with that.
Oh, I really believe when it comes down to it, if you want to boil it right down to the essence of what you just said, it can be said this way, that it's okay to be you.
Absolutely.
And most people do not believe. Yeah, yeah.
And most people are afraid to be them. They think if you really peeked inside and saw what I really think and what I really want to do and how I really feel about these issues, you might not like me that much. And then people get scared, you know, and fear is what a lot of these lies are based on. You know, it's based on trying to keep up a specific image and a specific level of control and security within your lives so that you never have to feel fear. You know, I tell patients, feel it. Sometimes you have to feel the fear and work through it to actually get to any form of freedom.
Oh, and absolutely, but that's what they're frightened to death of, because that fear may be something that they don't even know what it is, but they get that feeling. They're afraid of something, and most people won't do it. They're not willing to take that step because it's too scary to get themselves right in the middle of it. But obviously, what they've been doing for so many years, Sandra, they've been denying, and if you're in denial, there's where the problem starts. So working with somebody to come out of it and saying it's okay to be who they are, and they have to give themselves permission. Or if they're waiting for somebody else to do it, somebody should step up to the plate and say, I give you permission to feel good. And in a lot of cases, that's all it takes.
Exactly. When people start, and what I've found with most women, when they come in the office and I even bring up the concept of thinking that there's a lie at work within their life that's affecting them, most of them give me this look like, what? You know, I came here for the happy pill. Where's the happy pill? And the reality is when they really start getting into it with me, they really start getting to the core of it and start understanding what I'm saying and the concept, and we start working through the process, the first couple of weeks don't feel very good. You know, the first couple of weeks we're having to uproot some things that may be very well rooted in their lives. It can be things from childhood. It can be things from past relationships. You know, some of these are things that I actually have to say, you know, I'm an internist. I need to set you up with a counselor who can really work through these issues. But just having that relationship and being open enough to say, I don't think you just need a pill. I think we got to do something more to really get to the bottom of this, gives people so much freedom. They start thinking, I'm not crazy. Because that's what most people start thinking. I'm crazy and, okay, I need to go see a psychiatrist, and if I see that, then I'm labeled and I have all these stereotypes attached to me. No. All of us have things that we work through. Some have to have deeper roots pulled out to be able to get to the point of freedom. Some can just work through the process themselves, you know, just with a friend. And the issue is doing it, getting to the point where you give yourself permission to say, I want to feel better. I want to get past where I'm at right now. I do not want to feel bound in my own life.
No, and that's true. And I think a lot of it has to do with defining what their life is and defining what's going to make them feel good. And I think this goes beyond women. Men have the same exact issues also. Maybe it may framed a little differently, but if you really come down to it, it's the fear of change and the fear of not living up to what somebody thinks you should be. And that in and of itself is a cultural thing. We've been taught to do that. I've got to be a certain way because if I'm not, they won't like me. And you just said it earlier. And that's, I think, what you got to deal with.
And there's a lot of concerns about image and, you know, and a lot of people have this feeling that everything has to be perfect. You know, and if it's not perfect, then something's going to happen. Something bad's going to happen. You know, the book, I specifically talk about women just because that's what a majority of my patients happen to be. But I have found that most men who've read the book, you know, their husbands of the wives come in and say, we have the exact same lives. You know, they're a little bit different, how we manifest them. But we're going through the same things, you know, you ladies are going through. So I found that they are very similar. It's just how we approach them tends to be a little bit different. A lot of women put their perfection issues within their relationships. A lot of men seem to put their perfection issues within their career. It's still the same effect on your body, still the same effect on your mind and your ability to relax and enjoy life. It still has that same hold upon you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no question about it. And it affects every phase and facet of your life. There is no question about that. And I think when you start working with the women, they come in for one thing, but are you beginning to recognize like an overarching theme? They come in for a pain, but you know it's going to end up to be a certain thing. And can you get the feel of where they're going to go?
Each patient's different. Most of the time what ends up happening, it starts off as a regular office visit. You know, most of my patients come in, we have a typical doctor-patient relationship. We don't talk about any lies. You know, it's just a regular visit. They're happy, they feel good, you know, there's nothing that throws a red flag up for me. And then there's those certain ones that come in, and you can almost get a sense for it when they walk in. They walk in and they're just kind of slumped into the chair, and, you know, every question's answered with about two words, and you know, you can really tell that life is not delivering what they thought they needed out of it. You know, they're not having any joy out of life. And oftentimes, when I see that, I'll start asking, you know, is there anything going on at home or, you know, anything specific you want to talk about? 9 times out of 10, they'll go, nope.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, okay, this is going to be like pulling teeth. So, you know, we start asking questions and slowly kind of working through some of the questions I ask patients about their sleep habits and how are they eating and, you know, things to kind of help them see how stress may be affecting these different areas. You know, do a physical examination if all of a sudden you have lots of muscle spasms and they say, oh, yeah, my neck hurts every time I get off from work. You know, is there something at work that's bothering you? And what happens is as we work through it, the physical exam, they start opening up more. There's something about having your hands on someone that makes them start feeling a little bit more comfortable with you.
Yeah.
So as a physician, it puts me in a position where people automatically come there knowing that they're going to have to be vulnerable. And even though they think initially it's just going to be physically vulnerable, as the process works through the exam, they start becoming more emotionally vulnerable as well.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting point because you've got to be very careful with the way you bring it up when you know it's there and they know that you know. Oh, that, like, don't talk to me. And it's a very interesting game that's played, but once you see the game and you begin to understand it, the one thing they will do is keep coming back because they know that you know.
That's right, and when they start opening up, the next time they're not the emotional barriers aren't as closed in to you. Each time they see you, they're able to open up a little bit more to the point where they feel comfortable saying things to you that, you know, the first visit they may have never even thought of mentioning at a doctor's office. They start getting to the point where they trust you to be someone, a confidant to them, someone that they can open up and be real with.
Now, by the way, the patients that you see now, did they come to you because they know there's going to be a very comprehensive medical exam, and comprehensive meaning it's going to be all-encompassing? Are people coming to you expecting that now?
There are more patients that are coming in with that in mind. Like my first started my medical practice, it was very much a typical internal medicine practice. You know, it was just after one particular patient that I had that really just changed my way of approaching it. This particular patient, she'd seen me a few times. She'd never had any issues like the one she came in that day. And when she came in, my thinking was, okay, I probably should just give her a pill, but I knew in the back of my mind, if I give her a pill, she's going to be back the next month, no better. You know, there was obvious that she was having so much emotionally going on and so much that she had started believing about herself that was just draining her of all life. And once I started working with her, to be honest with you, it freed me. It freed me to be comfortable, you know, sharing that part of myself with patients.
Oh, by the way, I'm sure that when it comes down to it, the very thing that they're missing out there is the thing that you're providing, that understanding. And that in and of itself, that empathy, that's probably the key to be very successful as a professional, because there's a lot of people who just don't do that anymore. They're frightened to death of doing it. You do the wrong thing, you get sued, you know, and it's a reversible cause and effect, and it causes you not to be able to get that close. But I'm glad you're doing it anyway. Let me ask you this, Sandra. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. My personal website is Dr. Dalton Smith, DalTonSmith.com. And then Set Free to Live Free also has a website, SetFreeToLiveFreeBook.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
You're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this bit, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and then my friends is
a wrap. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again, but now...